Hi, this is Rusty Reno, editor of First Things Magazine. I'm in the editor's office here with Ramona Taus, our assistant editor, and we'd like to talk about the June-July issue out, 2 weeks ago, Ramona, is that right?
Oh, a little more than that, mid-May, yeah.
That's right, mid-May, so we're a little behind, aren't we?
Yep, just a little bit, but you know,
but it's a double June, issue, so we can be at leisure, I guess. So, let's just jump in. What stood out for you in this issue?
Well, I thought Aaron Cariotti had a really excellent piece in this issue, quite a gripping graphic piece, on organ donation. So Cariotti discusses his experiences dissecting human bodies in medical school, as well as the time he spent actually doing some organ transplant surgeries, to make a really powerful warning about the tendency we have when we grow so used to the concept of organ donation to start viewing the human body differently, perhaps even begin viewing it as a kind of commodity.
Yeah, I mean, traditional cultures always have certainly surround the dead body, for instance, with respect. So the idea of burial rather than
cremation.
Yeah, the idea of burial rather than cremation is a good example, but also in Judaism, you can't get tattoos. You're not supposed to deface or in any way mar the body. So there's a sense of the same. St. Paul says our bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit. And that does come out in the piece, doesn't it? In an odd way, because it's about, you know, this kind of medical interventions. There's a great passage, I love this one, and he's describing here being in the operating room. I think he's a resident here, and here's what he writes. The electric saw was buzzing. Bits of bone were flying, and a tendril of smoke wafted up from the point where saw met bone. We were amputating a leg. It was a surprisingly quick operation, no more than a half hour. Above the knee, the resident made a circumferential cut with a scalpel and tied off the few major leg vessels and continued cutting until he'd reached bone. Then it was time to pick up the saw, an instrument that did its work quickly. My job as medical student was to hold the leg. Suddenly, it was detached in my hands. Holding the leg freely was a strange sensation. I handed the amputated limb to a nurse who put it in a plastic bag marked biohazard and carried it out of the operating room. I mean, the article is full of these extremely vivid, I mean, I thought the writing was very powerful. It really brought out the way in which this sort of medical intervention into our bodies has a kind of visceral immediacy and power. And that really, to me, that brought out, in an odd way, the sacredness of the body. He talks about dissecting and how the sort of chatter of these medical students, they suddenly get hushed when they reveal the faces of the cadavers that they have been dissecting for the semester. And the sense of it's not just a body, but a person. And so body and personhood are connected to each other.
So it becomes this really powerful warning against starting to view the body as a collection of useful parts, as he puts it.
Right.
So Rusty, let me turn the question around to you. What stood out for you in this issue? Which piece was your favorite?
You know, the editor of the magazine is never supposed to have favorites.
Well, we know that's not true.
I really liked Rachel McNair's piece on the pro-life future. I think that, you know, we play so much defense, whether it's, the sexual revolution, the culture of death. We play so much defense that we often, I think it's easy to get demoralized. And one of the things I liked so much about her piece was it's a plan for how to move forward in the pro-life cause. It's a vision of how to win. And it's, you know, it's not Pollyannish and recognizes the hurdles that we have to overcome. She's She has, you know, been active in the pro-life cause for a long time, and certainly has seen a lot of successes. I mean, I think it's easy for someone sort of new to the movement, because it is such a source of despair to think that in our society we're so indifferent to the fate of the unborn. But you know, the kinds of foundations that have been laid for reversing that, I think, are very important. And so I like that one.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was good. When I was, you know, young, you know, abortion didn't have the stigma that it does now. I mean, even people who support Roe are embarrassed by the reality of abortion. And if you look at young OBGYN doctors, they don't perform abortions. So it's become stigmatized in all kinds of ways in the medical profession. And so I think there's been real progress on that score. And we're doing a kind of series of articles on economics. We had Richard Spady, when was that? That was maybe in the May or April issue,
yeah,
on
April.
Economics as ideology. There's some interesting letters in this issue on that as well. And then in this issue we have Tim Reichert and Fran Mayer, their article, Origami of the Soul.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an argument about the relation between market organization of society and what they call hierarchical institutions. I think by which they mean institutions that order or shape human behavior according to some good, as opposed to markets, where we decide what is good for us. You know, do I want to take a vacation to Europe, or do I want to go to the Caribbean? It's up to me. The market is neutral with respect to our desires, but hierarchical institutions try to shape our desires.
Right, and so they make this point that it's not so much a question of how regulated or unregulated the market should be, but where is the boundary line between hierarchical institutions and the market?
Right, and I thought that's very helpful. So that we often fixate on this question about do we have the right, you know, market philosophy, and which is an important question, obviously, and markets can be overregulated or they can be underregulated, but that really is a separate question from where the boundary is. I mean, I guess the old Sabbath laws preventing commerce on Sunday was an attempt to sort of keep the market at sort of to fence it, so to speak, so it doesn't invade the territory of the Sabbath.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good example, I think, of where you have a boundary line.
It's quite an abstract theoretical piece, and I think you get into more of the practical implications of that in your public square. You sort of discuss suggestions for how hierarchical institutions can better influence our society.
Really? Do I say that?
You do. You sort of organize it according to the three necessary societies.
Oh, right. Well, I guess, you know, Reichert and Mayer in their piece, it is abstract, so they don't tell us like what the hierarchical institutions are, although they do end with a discussion of the church being the most likely non-market institution to serve as a counterweight to markets in the kind of in the 21st century West. So they do that. And I've been very influenced by Russ Hittinger's piece that we published, gosh, I guess it was around this time last year, on the three necessary societies, family, polity, or nation, and church. And they're both, all three of them are things that we are loyal to for their own sake. So they're not instruments that we use to get something else. And I think it's very important as a way of restoring that boundary line between what you might call sort of economic life, and then hard to know what the right word is, social life or cultural life. And I think we need to put a lot of thought into how we can restore or encourage family, nation, national, civic culture, and religious communities. things have changed a lot. We rely on market thinking to a much greater extent. So it's natural for people of a certain kind of education to speak about the marriage market, for instance. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I was in college, no one ever spoke about the marriage market. This is not to say that it's not useful. Actually, Mark Vagnaris's book, Cheap Sex, makes very effective use of economic modeling to try to help illuminate some of the dysfunctions of the male-female dance in our contemporary scene. But it's interesting how market images, market analysis has become our kind of go-to category for thinking about why things are the way they are and how can we construct them or reconstruct them in a more harmonious fashion.
So, Rusty, perhaps we should at least mention the most controversial article in this issue.
Controversy? First thing, never has controversies.
We need to discuss a little bit of Peter Hitchens's Latimer and Ridley Are Forgotten. Now, there's an amusing anecdote behind how this came about. Can you share it with us?
Oh, yes, yes. You're reminding me, yeah. I think it was back when we published maybe it was a controversial review of a book about Edgardo Mortara, the Jewish child kidnapped in the Papal States in the 19th century. And it did raise, I guess, some comment, would be fair to say. And Alan Jacobs was huffing and puffing on Twitter about how Catholic First Things has become and that we can publish these things about that strike at Jewish sensibilities, but we would never publish something that would violate Catholic pieties. And so that caused me to think, and I emailed Peter Hitchens and said to him, hey, would you be interested in writing something that takes up the Elizabethan martyrs and defends Elizabethan policy? And he said, absolutely, he'd thought a lot about it already. And so he produced this piece for us, a argument that the Marian martyrs were martyrs of religious conscience, whereas Elizabethan martyrs were really political renegades, and that, or revolutionaries, or I guess counter-revolutionaries in this case, and that Elizabeth's policies were politically motivated, not religiously motivated. Mm-hmm. I don't altogether agree with that argument because it's very anachronistic to separate the religious from the political in the 16th century. But he does make a kind of strong case that Mary's persecution of Protestants that produced the martyrs that fill Fox's Book of Martyrs, that those persecutions were much more ardent and clearly more motivated by a kind of religio-political project of reestablishing Catholicism in England, whereas Elizabeth's policies were much more reluctantly adopted in the face of foreign threat, of course, epitomized by the Spanish Armada in 1588. So there's something there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not everything that gets published in a magazine reflects the editor's opinion.
No, certainly not. Because
if it did, it would be very boring. I think it's James Madison who says that we don't want we want a mild and equitable establishment of religion. And I think that's part of Hitchens' argument. His argument is by the time you get to Elizabeth, something like the Anglican via media is formulated. And that means it's a sort of neither fish nor fowl, not ardently, dogmatically, zealously Protestant, but also not dogmatically, ardently, and zealously Catholic. And Anglicanism is always criticized for being milquetoast-ish when it comes to theology, and I think there's something to that criticism. But the effect of it politically was that it was a pretty soft establishment by the standards of the day. And I think this is something that gains Hitchens' approval, this kind of approach. And he regrets the way in which in the late 20th century, this kind of cultural Christianity that formed a unifying center for English culture, it drained away very, very quickly. So that at this point, one reads him wondering if he's the last, Anglican standing in England. But I do love the nostalgia atmosphere. I think nostalgia is a falsely criticized emotion.
Hmm.
I think that we recall in the kind of golden haze of recollection the goods that have been lost, and that's a useful exercise of the moral imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't mean we want to go back to 19th century dentistry, and it certainly doesn't mean that Peter Hitchens wants to go back to burning or executing Catholic priests, or for that matter, political, treasonous figures. In fact, I think he states at the outset that he's opposed to capital punishment in any form. So really, I think the nostalgia that animates this is the nostalgia for that kind of Christian society that didn't fuss to make everyone part of the sort of central consensus.
I love this anecdote at the end in which Hitchens describes coming out of church at King's College, Cambridge, and tourists say to him, "Is the Church of England Catholic or Protestant?"
Well, here, let's read it. "More than once, as I have left Evensong at King's College, Cambridge, one of the last strongholds of Anglican beauty, I have been asked by puzzled tourists from the continent whether the Church of England is Protestant or Catholic. If Roman Catholicism had not been so preoccupied with asserting its power, it could have saved many good men and women from horrible, needless deaths and done no harm to the faith of Christ crucified. What a pity that politics triumphed over religion. Let that flawed man, Thomas Cranmer, in one of his great and moving colics, have the last word in this. Almighty God, the fountain of all wisdom, who knowest our necessities before we ask, and our ignorance in asking, we beseech thee to have compassion upon our infirmities, and those things which for our unworthiness we dare not, and for our blindness we cannot ask, vouchsafe to give us, for the worthiness of thy Son, Jesus Christ our Lord. I have long believed that he remembered these words before going to his death, and I hope I shall have them by heart when I go to mine." So it's a
powerful ending.
Yeah, it's a powerful ending, and certainly Cranmer was the greatest author of liturgical language, I think, in the English speaking tradition. George Rutler famously, when he was asked after he became a Catholic priest, he had been an Anglican minister before, he was asked what he missed most about Anglicanism, and he said the liturgy in English.
That's great. So Rusty, anything else that stood out to you in this issue?
I want to go to, we're doing a kind of series on work. We had an opinion piece. We had an opinion piece by
C.R. Wiley.
Yep, C.R. Wiley on manual manhood. And that fits with, remember John Waters' wonderful piece on Back to Work? And so, you know, I hope we don't become one of these kind of weird, masculinist magazines or whatever, thinking we have to have men's rights or something absurd like that. But there is something interesting here about work, working with your hands, and the kind of wisdom that comes from that, that I think it kind of goes back to Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. That was a book that was kind of a big when I was young. And we've got some material in development on household. A friend of mine who raises pigs, you know, when he slaughters his pigs, he invites his neighbors over, and There's just something about it. It goes back to Aaron Cariotti's essay. Being connected with physical reality is to be in touch with something that has power, intrinsic power. And one of the crises of our digital age is our loss of contact with the real. John Waters said that his father, who could plumb the door jam, take an accurate measure as he did his carpentry, could also take the measure of men and his supposed betters, whether they were really talking a line or whether they were talking about something that was real. I think there's something to that.
Yeah, he has this nice discussion, Wiley does, of the hierarchy that develops on a job site among men.
Right, that's a nice tie back with the origami of the piece, origami of the soul piece, because it's a good illustration that, you know, there are many trades. We call them trades, not jobs. They're trades, and the trades have their own traditions, their own hierarchies, and so it's not the case that our economic lives are purely market defined. That they also have hierarchies and traditions and norms and so forth that I think are important. Mark Bauerlein's written about that in some of his back page about when he was selling racing forms. And there's a kind of interaction that you develop, and there's a way in which we, as human beings, are always seeking non-utilitarian ways to relate to each other. We don't just want to use each other. We want to be together doing something that matters for its own sake.
So Rusty, I really also enjoyed your comments on Mary as a model for the intellectual life in your public square this month.
You know, I was asked to give a talk at Yale, invited by the Thomistic Institute, and I thought, you know, I'm going to give a lecture at Yale that students are probably not going to otherwise hear. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, Mary can provide us with a guidance to how to be an intellectual, to honor truth. I mean, she's a custodian of divine truth. She receives the divine word and carries it in her. She gives birth to the divine word, gives it, if you will, to the world. There are episodes in the New Testament when Jesus stays behind as a young kid, and she and Joseph go back to the temple, and he's having this very sophisticated back and forth with the teachers of the law, and she ponders these things in her heart. So she also, the kind of contemplation the Virgin Mary manifests is, or that she exemplifies, is not just a contemplation in some abstract sense, but it also involves contemplation of truth, and that's really ultimately what the end of the intellectual life is. That's the goal of the intellectual life. So I go through the idea of her purity and the sense in which we should be seeking purity of vision or clarity of vision, and we should be seeking intellectual incorruptibility. And I'm going to come back to this theme on Mary as the exemplar of the intellectual life in the upcoming issues, because in this one I talk about purity. I'm going to also talk about humility, and I think that's going to be in August and September, and then carry forward with courage and joy.
Looking forward to it.
All right, well, great to talk about the issue, and I hope folks who are listening are regular readers, and if you're not, you should definitely be going to firstthings.com and signing up for a subscription. All people of discriminating intellect read First Things.